2 days before the UK election, dear listeners, Prime Minister Theresa May had this to say when she was trying to promote herself as being the tough PM for tough times in Britain and Europe. If human rights get in the way of doing these things, we will change those laws to make sure we can do them. No more would instructions like the European Court on Human Rights dictate for Britons what they could or couldn't do. Now, that might sound to the untrained ear a bit Churchillian, when you couldn't be wronger, to coin a phrase. Churchill wasn't like that at all, according to my next guest, who's sitting opposite in our Sydney studio. Marco Durante is a long-term gladdy, also a lecturer in modern European and international history at the University of Sydney. And I'm holding up, oh, it's heavy, I'm holding up for the listeners to see this splendid tome of his. The cover is a photograph from behind the hulking, looming figure of Churchill as he gazes out on a large crowd. And the book is called The Conservative Human Rights Revolution. News to me. So, Marco, explain what the hell you're on about. I must say, having read the book, you are going to aggravate both the left and the right.
Well, I hope to persuade the left and the right. Maybe I'm doing the right thing if I'm aggravating both of them. Well, thanks so much for having me on. The book is about the conservative origins of human rights and also the conservative origins of the European Union. Today, we often think of human rights as a progressive project, at least many of those.
Put together by a bunch of lefties, yes.
Right. We often tell the story of human rights, starting somewhere in the Enlightenment or the French Revolution and the American Revolution, and then going onwards to the various movements for reform in the 19th century, finally culminating in the Holocaust and the Second World War and the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 by the United Nations.
In which Australia played a modest role.
Right, absolutely. And in fact, the Australian delegation to the United Nations was the only delegation to propose the creation of a human rights court. This was well before, of course, the creation of the International Criminal Court. And at the time, within the halls of the UN, at least, and in the world of international law, this notion that there would be a court of human rights was laughed at. So the Australians found themselves alone there. But quite extraordinarily, 2 years after the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights came the adoption of the European Convention on Human Rights, which then led to the creation of the European Court of Human Rights.
Now, this is where we talk Churchill, yes?
Yeah.
Now, isn't it interesting? When I think of Churchill, most Australians have very mixed feelings. We're a little bit unhappy with him over Gallipoli, for example. Mm-hmm. But we also recognise his incredible, blind courage standing against Hitler when many in Britain, including a great many in the elite, wanted to capitulate or negotiate. So, he's admired and despised pretty much. And yet here he is, to my astonishment, being a driving force for a human rights court.
Yeah, funnily enough, given the well over 100 books with Churchill in the title and mountains more books that feature him prominently, nobody has written a book until now. About his participation in this extraordinary campaign for the creation of a human rights court, which is in effect a kind of supreme court of Europe that resides today in Strasbourg. And as I said, at the time, that notion was considered fantastical, absolutely utopian, only a couple years before.
So he'd be rather cross with Theresa May, wouldn't he?
Yeah, well, I believe so. Theresa May, from her time as Home Secretary, has been on a kind of crusade to push Britain to exit the European Convention on Human Rights and exit the jurisdiction of the European Court. What we saw in the Conservative Manifesto was a retreat on that position because there are divisions within the Conservative Party today, just like there were divisions on the question of Europe back in the 1940s and 50s and within the Conservative Party then. We saw a retreat, but then, you know, shortly before the election itself, after the London attack, Theresa May seemed to go once again in the other direction, saying she would want to kind of, you know, rip up the existing human rights legislation in Britain. So Churchill, I believe, would have, you know, very much been opposed to what in the manifesto is described as a rejection of what they call the libertarian right. And it's basically a move of the Conservative Party towards a more populist form of conservatism that we see not only in Britain, but
we see it all over, don't we? It's right. It's been a great tidal wave. We're talking about the conservative human rights revolution, about conservative revolutionaries, well, at very least conservative progressives, with Marco Durante. Marco, why do you think the Tories and other conservatives have historical amnesia on this issue?
That's a very good question. I think it's in part because the one of the reasons why Tories such as Churchill were so supportive of a creation of a European Human Rights Court, and I should say besides supportive by the late 1940s of Britain's entry into some kind of European Union, in part because they were in opposition. It was in part was the momentary anxieties that Churchill had as leader of opposition. It should be remembered that Churchill was decisively defeated in the July 1945 general election in Britain.
To worldwide astonishment and his own.
Right, absolutely. And you saw swept into power the Labour Party with a large majority, with a very ambitious agenda of social reform, of nationalizations, of economic planning. On the other side of the channel in France, you saw the socialists and communists gain a parliamentary majority that same year. So conservatives found themselves all of a sudden in a position of weakness.
And to some extent, you point out that, well, as we know, in this sort of binary left-right argument, conservatives and the left neither know their history. The left attacks the conservatives as being anti-human rights, not realizing that one of the main reasons the convention and the court was set up was to prevent the left enacting legislation against conservative ideals. Please explain.
Right. So for conservatives in Europe, and I use that expression Europe because Churchill described himself as a good European and very much certainly by the middle decades of the 20th century, saw Britain as part of Europe, or at least European civilization. So conservatives in Europe in the late 1940s, in the aftermath of this cataclysm that had engulfed the continent, all of a sudden found themselves fearing for their individual liberties. Whether in Britain, the conservatives genuinely thought that Britain was going down the path of authoritarianism. Churchill famously, in his inaugural campaign address in 1945, he warned the electors that if they elected a Labour government, that government would create some form of Gestapo. Those were his words.
This is the same fellow who memorably said in a speech in the US that an iron curtain was coming down all over Europe. So he was... he was, in fact, helping polarize opinion.
Yeah, I think, you know, fear of communism was certainly at the forefront of the concerns of the conservative inventors of the European Court of Human Rights, undoubtedly. Both the memories of fascism and the horrors of the war and the Nazi genocide and the menace of communism that was growing by the day. You know, in the early 1948, you had... a communist seizure of power in Czechoslovakia, which sent shockwaves of fear across the continent and Britain.
This was a domino theory before that term was applied to what was happening in Asia with Vietnam.
Yes, exactly. So you have this rapid acceleration of the Cold War, but communism was not the only specter that was haunting Churchill. and haunting Europe at that time for conservatives. He believed, as did another key player in this story, who was David Maxwell Fyfe, a fellow Tory politician, who was instrumental in drafting the European Convention on Human Rights. They believed that socialism was a kind of gateway to totalitarianism. They looked back to Nazi...
Just as marijuana inevitably leads to addiction to heroin, the same sort right. of well, slippery slope.
Yeah, they looked at measures such as economic planning, and today we you know, if you say economic planning, the first thing we don't think of is maybe, you know, the totalitarianism. But when they thought of economic planning, they thought of Nazi Germany, they thought of the Soviet Union. And so when these socialist governments declared that there would be unprecedented state intervention in the economy and social affairs, the nationalization of industries, the extraordinary powers of the state in 1945, which had grown immensely during the Second World War, that these would now be in the hands of socialists.
So the man with the black dog became the man on the white horse. Mm-hmm. This changes my knowledge of the era quite dramatically. What did the left think? Did they must have been, shall we say, a little bit anxious?
Well, so much of the left identified both European integration and the project for this Human Rights Convention and Human Rights Court as a distinctly conservative project. They saw both of them as aimed at reviving a discredited conservatism, a conservatism that in their eyes had failed to address the economic crises of the 1930s, that had favored appeasement, that in some cases on the continent had collaborated with the Axis powers, that they saw that Churchill taking the leadership of this movement for a united Europe as a way to revive his political fortunes, but in addition saw this Human Rights Court as a bastion against social reform.
Did the human rights notion, that organization, did that not make some of the conservatives feel threatened about their nation's power? The United States, for example, has been absolutely reluctant. They've just refused to sign up for the, for Geneva, for example, The Hague.
Yeah, so typically we think of conservatives as nationalists, and we think of conservatives in Britain, for example, as being...
When you think of Donald Trump.
Right. So we think of them as being very skeptical about international law and international organizations, certainly not a group that would be supportive of creating a kind of European Supreme Court that could interfere in the workings of the domestic legal system. So, but what we should also remember is that courts were traditionally, for much of European history, considered to be conservative institutions, bastions of... of conservative attempts to defend property rights, to crack down on left-wing organizations. We should recall the role of the British courts in repressing left-wing organizations in Britain, the Communist Party, trade unions. In France, the courts were long associated with the Ancien Régime, this old aristocratic power. They were considered inimical to the principle of popular sovereignty, whereas it was the will of the people expressed through the National Assembly that was supposed to be the basis of political authority, not judges.
You mentioned in passing David Maxwell Fyfe. Now, Sir David, the record show, was the Deputy Chief Prosecutor and the de facto head of the British legal term at the Nuremberg trials. One can see that as being a precursor.
Yes, so David Maxwell Fyfe is most famous for his role as deputy British prosecutor at Nuremberg, and he was at the time hailed by the British press as the Atlas of Nuremberg. He was a fearsome figure. He was celebrated for his ruthless cross-examinations of figures such as Goering and a host of other Nazi grandees. At the time, and he was celebrated.
Someone described him as cold as ice with a mind like a spitfire.
Right. The thing about Maxwell Fyfe that people forget is, first of all, he had been in favor of the Munich Accords and of Neville Chamberlain's strategy of appeasement before the war. But also what they forget is that there was a side to him that wasn't so cold, that there was a kind of Christian romantic in David Maxwell Fife. In fact, at the towards the end of the Nuremberg trials, he quotes Rupert Brooke's War Sonnet, The Soldier. And he talks about the souls of the fallen British soldiers who died at the front in the First World War, coming back to England. And so there's this great kind of longing and nostalgia in David Maxwell Fife for an earlier time, one in which
and also a desire perhaps to expiate guilts from his support.
Yeah.
Then would say pre-war he's anti-Churchillian, isn't he? So they make an unlikely couple.
Well, Churchill always called David Maxwell's wife Sir Donald, I imagine, on purpose.
On purpose.
they were not, even though they were close colleagues in the 1940s, they weren't the best of friends. But David Maxwell Fife, even more than Churchill, was absolutely convinced that Britain was on this slow descent into totalitarian rule under socialist ministers and bureaucrats. And
so a venture that starts out just out of all sorts of, for all sorts of right and wrong reasons, goes on to become incredibly important.
Yes, he does. He is the most influential figure in crafting the document that eventually becomes the European Convention on Human Rights. And he ensures, first of all, that the document will not be modeled on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yes. So, for example, social rights, which are very prominent in the Universal Declaration, the right to health care, the right to social security, the right to employment. Those
That's
are
a
not
bit in, left wing.
Well, those are not in the European Convention on Human Rights, and precisely because those were the rights that were most dear to socialists. In fact, what is in the European Convention on Human Rights are civil liberties, the prohibition against torture, but also very controversially property rights, for example. And this was something that socialists, both in Britain and on the continent, fought tooth and nail their inclusion. So,
Marco, this is terrific stuff. A lot of talk today about West versus Islam, especially in Europe. Mm. But in the 40s, Churchill and other European intellectuals were speaking of the unification of Europe as a Christian mission.
Yeah, so today we often think there is a divide between the West and the non-West, so to speak, on the question of human rights. There's this famous Asian values debate where it's said that in Asia, instead of a Western notion of human rights based on individual freedom, instead there are ideas about duty to the community. And so it's often understood that either the human rights are a product of the West, or this is the big divide, right? And what I would try to stress is that within the West itself, there was a great deal of contestation about this term human rights. And on the one hand, you had a more progressive interpretation in the 1940s, one that stressed social rights, for example, and one that came out of this legacy of the French Revolution and Enlightenment, a kind of secular understanding of human rights. But you also had a conservative Christian vision of human rights, and one that was embraced both by Tories such as Churchill, but also by the French Catholics that I discuss in my book as well.
It's interesting, isn't it, that just many Australian conservatives, when they hear the term human rights, make the sign of the cross and say unclean, unclean. So your book is timely because it's also under great stress with the Trump administration and, of course, throughout the Islamic world. This is a time of crisis where human rights is no longer a given.
Absolutely. And, it's interesting that Trump attacked the federal courts in the U.S. with his tweets. In the U.K., during the debate over whether Parliament would have to sign off on Brexit, you had right-wing tabloids whose headlines screamed, "Enemies of the People," showing the judges of the British Supreme Court. So what you have now is a kind of conservative populist assault on judicial power.
And on the notion of human rights.
And on the notion of human rights itself.
So making this, being a heretic and revealing to us that this is not a triumph for the left, but in fact was born in conservative thinking, is very, very powerful.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, human rights had many different meanings, as I said, and that it was seen, you know, not only in Britain, because the book also talks a good deal about France. So you had French Catholics who were often quite critical of democracy in the interwar period, who were quite critical of secular values, who then started to embrace this remarkable institution of the European Court of Human Rights to defend what they saw as Christian values.
Marco, great to talk to you. Marco Durante is lecturer in modern European and international history at the University of Sydney, and his book, which is a great thumping one, The Conservative Human Rights Revolution, published by Oxford University Press.